Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. A bipartisan group of U.S. congressional leaders have reached agreement on new sanctions for Russia in response for its meddling in the 2016 presidential election, as well as a provision that would prevent President Trump from trying to relax sanctions against Moscow. The bill was passed more than a month ago by the U.S. Senate and also included new sanctions against Iran for its ballistic missile testing. Police in the southern U.S. state of Texas say 8 people have been found dead in the back of a tractor trailer on a Walmart parking lot. San Antonio Fire Chief Charles Hood says at least 28 people, including children, were pulled out of the truck, with 17 of them suffering critical heat-related injuries. The fire chief told CNN some of the survivors have suffered irreversible brain damage. Hood said the people would not have survived another night in that trailer. San Antonio's temperatures have been hot and dry. The trailer was a refrigerator truck, but the air conditioning was not working. He said the truck's driver has been arrested. The people were found after someone from the truck asked a Walmart employee for water. Heavy fighting is continuing to rage in central Afghanistan, where officials say the Islamist Taliban has captured 2 key district headquarters and is assaulting government outposts in nearby areas. A government spokesman told VOA around 700 Taliban insurgents overnight attacked Khorasan and swiftly captured key installations, including the police headquarters, before establishing control over the entire district. Insurgents had continued to attack government positions in 8 other districts. This is VOA News. Venezuela's opposition announced a 2-day national strike this week aimed at pressuring President Nicolas Maduro to cancel a controversial July 30th election for a new Congress. Protesters rallied Saturday in Caracas for a march toward the embattled nation's Supreme Court, chanting slogans opposing President Maduro's plan to rewrite the Constitution. National Guard troops used tear gas in at least one location, blocking protesters with clouds of white gas and rows of officers on motorcycles. The UN Security Council has scheduled an emergency meeting for Monday to discuss the recent spate of violence, including the clashes late Saturday when some Muslim men defiantly held evening prayers outside after being denied entrance to the holy site Muslims call Noble Sanctuary and Jews call Temple Mount. Earlier, UN spokesman Farhan Haq said Secretary General is calling on all political, religious, and community leaders to help reduce tension, citing comment from the UN Special Coordinator for the Middle East Peace Process.
The need by all sides to avoid escalating tensions and to avoid any steps that lead to further violence. Mr. Mladenov has appreciated the stated commitment by the Israeli Prime Minister to preserve the status quo at the holy sites.
Escalating Israeli-Palestinian tensions over the Holy Land's most contested shrine boiled over into violence with 3 deaths. At least 60 people have been kidnapped from a village in southern Kandahar, Afghanistan, by Taliban insurgents, with 7 of those prisoners reportedly killed. A spokesman for the provincial governor told the AP the villagers were kidnapped in a series of Taliban attacks on buses over the last 4 days. More than 100 Somalis recently released from Ethiopian detention facilities and handed over to Somali government have arrived in Mogadishu. Government officials told local media the Somali prisoners had been held in Ethiopian jails for various offenses, including illegal entry. 2 aftershocks hit the Greek island of Kos Saturday night, just a day after a 6.7 magnitude earthquake killed 2 people and injured nearly 500 others. The Athens Geodynamics Institute reports the first aftershock, a 4.4 magnitude tremor, hit the island around 8 p.m. local time and was quickly followed 16 minutes later by a 4.6 magnitude tremor. The earthquake is the second in the region this year to exceed a magnitude of 6.0, a level that can cause considerable damage. More at voanews.com. I'm Tommy McNeil in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
We publish on our website the register of voters, all the 19.6 million with complete names. We've just truncated the ID numbers because of privacy issues.
The Kenyan Electoral Commission releases the voter list to be used for the upcoming general election.
3 or 4 months ago, I held an interview on the Voice of America, and I mentioned to you all that I had implicit confidence in the Election Commission. But I think it's time now to re-examine that decision.
A Liberian presidential candidate expresses concern the upcoming presidential vote could be compromised.
Approximately 33,000 commercial farmers in South Africa are currently ensuring food security for a population determined by Statistics South Africa to be about 55 million.
And rains break the worst drought in South Africa for more than a century. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The Kenyan Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission, or IEBC, has released the voter list to be used for the upcoming August 8 general election. It comes after a recent court ruling which backs the electoral body's decision to award the printing of the ballot papers to a Dubai-based printing company, Al Ghurair. The Dubai-based company was awarded the contract to print ballot papers for the elections. But the main opposition, the National Super Alliance, or NASA, challenged the contract, saying the company is linked to incumbent President Uhuru Kenyatta. For the latest development about the voter list, I reached Andrew Limo, spokesman for the Kenyan Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission, IEBC.
We publish on our website the register of voters, all the 19.6 million with complete names. We've just truncated the ID numbers because of privacy issues. But one can check the constituency and ward and up to the polling station and get to know all the people. This is for the purpose of inspection because we have to give clarity and the people have to know who is voting. They can now check because we came from the stage of verification where they were checking for their details. Now it's the time to check who else is in the register, so that if there are people that they feel they have concerns, then people can raise, like issues of dead voters. You would know who is on the register. Yes, this will help us to ensure that voters know their voting station where they're going to vote, so there will be no long queues this time around.
The main opposition coalition, NASA, recently expressed concern to the visiting African Union officials, specifically saying that they have concerns about the voter list. How are you addressing this?
Peter, I think by the commission publishing the register is one way of ensuring transparency. So everybody knows who is now on the register. So it's no secret anymore. We do admit that there are dead voters, but if you look at it, we don't have the mechanism to remove dead voters unless advised by the Registrar of Births and Deaths. We would not read from newspapers that somebody has passed on, and so we go to the register and delete. There's this story that is told and this reality that when we ran some of the lists that we were given against current candidates, we actually found that 7 of them were reading dead from the list that we were given. So sometimes the integrity of the data that we get is also questionable, and we must subject it to, you know, the ones we deleted, over 80,000 were those that the names that were given to us and IDs matched perfectly with the names of those that were said were dead. And so we were sure those were dead.
Recently, a court ruled paving the way for the ballot papers to be printed by the Dubai-based company. So far, what is the status of the printing of the ballot papers to be used for the election?
We have received most of the papers for the position of senator, governor, We have the member of National Assembly, that's the MPs, and I think we already started receiving some of the MCA, and we expect presidential ballot papers to come in and all ballot papers to be in by 3rd of August.
In the transportation of the ballot papers from Dubai to Kenya ahead of the elections, are political parties and other stakeholders part to safeguard as part of the transparency process of the IEBC to ensure fairness to prevent possible accusation of collusion or undermining the integrity of the election?
We have exceedingly involved all stakeholders, political parties, and even the media. You'll recall that we provided for media and political parties, some of them representatives, to travel to Dubai where the printing was so that they understand the process. And when they land at the airport, we make provisions for the media to just check the process, how it's going on, and ask questions where they have any concerns. And I think we've been as transparent as we possibly could. And now we will embark on distributing the 40,883 polling stations. And I think that is where really the challenge is. I mean, in terms of timelines, it was not only the printing, even the distribution. Securely distributing to all over the country is quite an enormous task.
When will distribution begin?
Basically, that would be the first week of August. It could start earlier, but they have to be there at the polling station 2-3 days before polling. Yeah, so I think all is okay.
Andrew Limo is the spokesman for the Kenyan Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission, or IEBC. He spoke with me from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. A Liberian presidential candidate has expressed concern about the ability of the National Elections Commission to administer free, fair, and credible elections. Businessman Benoni Yure, leader of the opposition All Liberian Party, says he is reconsidering his proud belief that the electoral body would organize transparent elections. Yure told me earlier that his party is now demanding the resignation of the Supreme Court judges after accusing them of losing the confidence Liberians had in them.
3 or 4 months ago, I held an interview on the Voice of America, and I mentioned to you all that I had implicit confidence in the Election Commission. But I think it's time now to re-examine that decision, not necessarily the Election Commission, but other branches of government, okay, who we believe are interfering in the electoral process. We issued a press release, and we called for the resignation of the entire bench of the Supreme Court. We also ask the legislative branch of government to begin impeachment trials in the instance that the Supreme Court bench refuses to resign.
Yure, why is your party calling on the entire Supreme Court bench to resign, knowing that it's just only a few weeks away for the election? If there is an election dispute, they are the same people who will be ruling on this case of election dispute.
The Supreme Court, they're not credible again. Look, for the Supreme Court, the 3 months ago ruled that the code of conduct is constitutional and it's the law of the land. 3 days ago, the same Supreme Court ruled that the decision by the Election Commission that Harrison Conway was in violation of the code of conduct and should be banned from running as vice president on the Liberty Party ticket. They stated that this action was egregious. But this action is the same action that Kamala sought to take. Kamala worked for the government, okay, and he didn't resign 2 years prior to the election. Why should the law be interpreted in one way for one candidate and interpreted the other way for the other candidate?
Looking at some of these challenges, you having problems with the Electoral Commission and other government agencies, why would you still want to participate in this upcoming election? Why?
Look, we want to use this opportunity to ask the international community to get involved in this process. Look, because the situation here is not whether somebody violated a law or should be punished. No, it's a criteria set up for election. It's like saying the age you have to be 18 years old to become a citizen. If you're not 18, you don't qualify for it. In this instance, they're saying you have to resign your government position 2 years before the election to qualify to run for an electoral position. Why is the Supreme Court trying to make laws for Liberia? They do not make laws for Liberia. They interpret the laws for Liberia. And we're going to participate in this election because these are all clever attempts by manipulators in this government to try to stop this electoral process. We're going to go through it to the end. They're wasting their time. We in Liberia, we're cognizant of all these tricks and artifacts that politicians in Liberia, people who have been in power for many years and have failed the Liberian people.
How do you intend working with other political parties to ensure that your party protects the vote of Liberians who go to the polls in a few weeks' time?
I think other political parties share the same view the all Liberian parties share regarding the decision of the Supreme Court. And we understand that early next week, you will hear from other political parties. Look, we also were a little concerned when Councillor Brumskin appeared on the Voice of America and asked the president to intervene to ensure that everybody participates in the election. He's a councillor of law, and he goes on the international wire and asks the president to violate the laws of Liberia. We condemn this request of his, and we condemn it in the strongest terms. And look, this is why we're saying some of these actions, we need international help on it. This is why we're calling for the creation of a war crime tribunal in this country, because our people are suffering too much.
Benoni Yure is the leader of the opposition All Liberian Party. He spoke with me from the capital, Monrovia. Ida Hoffman is a Namibian parliamentarian who has been championing the rights of the Nama and Herero ethnic groups massacred by Germany between 1904 and 1908. The parliamentarian says it appears the government is not doing enough to back the two ethnic groups in their demands for reparations and an apology from Germany. Considered by some historians as the first genocide of the 20th century, tens of thousands of men, women, and children from the Herero and Nama ethnic groups in Namibia were killed in battle or died of starvation, cold, or mistreatment. Ida Hoffman told me she would continue the fight in Parliament until the demands of the two ethnic groups are realized.
In Parliament, it is where late Chief Kaimo Riroaku, he brought the motion in the Parliament. And when he brought the motion in the Parliament, first of all, he was just talking about the Hereros. And it was very good, my presence in the Parliament, where I can also stand up and say the Namas too. It is where it comes in the Parliament, Namas and Hereros. The motion was accepted unanimously. The Nama Herero genocide issue fully as it was presented the resolution in the Parliament.
Why are you saying the government appears not to accept it? Because the government has chosen a representative to negotiate with the German government.
It is now after 10 years after we fight for this whole thing now. And see, we didn't stop where we even take it now to the court. It is where our government come in. But, you know, they come in with words that they said now, 50-50. 50, who? It is the government with some other representatives, and 50, we. Now, that is not what the resolution said. The resolution said, Nama Herero. And then it is the table. It is acknowledgement. It is apology. It is all skulls and remains, documents, whatever is there, what the Bible of Hendrik Witbooi, that those things must be repatriated back to the country. And reparation has to be paid in the same way how they have also paid all the other countries.
What is the situation like in your fight for the recognition of the genocide committed against the Herero and the Nama ethnic groups in Namibia, as well as the reparations that you seek?
Now, they recognize the Namaherero. But according to them, is that the other tribes was also killed by the Germans. We don't deny that. No, that is not what we denied. We talk about the extermination order, which was being written out directly to the Namas and to the Hereros. Namas, 1905, that was the 22nd of April, and the Hereros then, the 2nd October 2004. So that is what we are standing on. We don't say, not the others. But then also for your information and the whole nation to know that those people was there in the parliament when we was deeply discussing this matter. And now Ovambo or Damara or some people have stand up and brought their case. So now the government wanted to use those people to know. It is where they said 50-50. That means the other Ovambos, Damaras, and all these other people must come now directly now with us to the table.
It appears there's division among the ethnic groups. So how do you move this thing forward? Because if you are not presenting a united front, definitely you couldn't have any negotiated settlement to resolve some of your concerns.
All the other tribes was there in the parliament. You hear me? They was in the parliament when we discussed it. And for them, it was just as it is nothing. They was making a laughing stock to us, especially me and late Temo Chief Riruaku, who was defending and fight for the rights of the Namas and the Hereros. But now all of a sudden, when they now see, oh, this thing is now coming up, and now it looks like that these people go to the table. And now they are going to the table. Reparation will be paid. They wanted to be now around the table. And that it is that they can come. But we talk about extermination order. We are not there for any infighting amongst them. Because my said issue was there. So directly fight, you know, the Namas and the Hereros with the other tribes is not there. It is not there. Maybe it will come up later, but right now it is not there.
Ida Hoffman is a Namibian parliamentarian. She spoke with me from the capital, Windhoek. Rains have broken the worst drought in South Africa for more than a century. There's a bumper harvest of maize on the way, a lot of it destined for other parts of sub-Saharan Africa, where a billion people eat maize as their staple diet. South African production of other grains and meat is also increasing. Yet, one of the country's major agricultural unions says the future of local commercial farmers remains dire. For VOA, Darren Taylor reports from Johannesburg.
Chris Van Sail is deputy manager of the TLU, representing thousands of South African commercial farmers. Van Sail says their importance to Southern Africa and beyond is underestimated because large-scale farming of food crops and job creation has failed across the region. Foreigners are thus streaming into South Africa.
Approximately 33,000 commercial farmers in South Africa are currently ensuring food security for a population determined by Statistics South Africa to be about 55 million. But if we include the number of foreigners which have crossed our borders, the total number of people in South Africa depending on at least a meal a day is in excess of about 65 million.
In 1994, when South Africa became a democracy, the TLU says there were 65,000 white commercial farmers in the country. Their decrease, says Van Sail, is because they and their workers are under siege, as he describes it.
We've had a huge problem with violent crimes on farms. And in this case, according to the statistics available to us, almost 2,000 farm dwellers have been murdered since January 1990. I have not included the consequences of injury, of loss of limb or the trauma, and I have not included the results of theft, especially stock theft, which is running rife at the moment.
Some political parties in South Africa say white-owned farmland must simply be given to blacks. The Department of Agriculture itself says if white landowners continue abandoning food production, It'll fill their absence partly with smallholder black farmers. Van Sail describes this as impractical.
Now, if we think that with the restricted area of high potential agricultural land, we can produce sufficient food for the population as well as for neighboring countries, then I think everybody is in for a surprise, because small-scale farming will not be able to produce the volumes which are required.
The drought was particularly bad in western South Africa, where many ranches raise beef cattle. Van Sail says the government's support with fodder to prevent farmers slaughtering starving cattle arrived too late. The agricultural department has acknowledged this.
Many of the stock farmers had to drastically reduce their herds, and it will take at least 4 to 5 years before those farmers can again reach the levels of income prior to the drought. Some of the dry land maize and corn farmers could not put a harvest in the soil. That resulted in a total lack of income,
leaving many, says Van Sail, under severe pressure.
Recently, the suicide of a well-known farmer in the Eastern Cape was reported. It was recently reported by a representative of an insurance company that suicide amongst farmers last year has increased by 20%.
Economists estimate South African farmers owe about 160 billion rand, or about $12 billion in debt. Van Sail says many won't be able to afford this. They're leaving the land and placing much of Southern Africa's future food security in jeopardy. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
35 European children have died from measles in the past 12 months in what the World Health Organization calls an unacceptable tragedy. The deaths could have been prevented by a vaccine. A measles outbreak in Minnesota sent nearly 24 people to the hospital. Still, some parents in developed countries continue to believe false reports that the measles vaccine causes autism. And now a number of parents are refusing to get their children vaccinated for other diseases as well. VOA's Carol Pearson reports from Washington.
A vaccine ended smallpox. Another is close to ending polio. Vaccines prevent flu, hepatitis, liver cancer, cervical, oral, and penile cancers, and a dozen or so other diseases. They have saved countless lives and prevented enormous suffering. Scientists are now working on vaccines for AIDS, malaria, and tuberculosis. Dr. Flavia Bustreo is an outspoken advocate for immunizations at the World Health Organization.
The immunization and vaccines are the most powerful public health tool that we have.
One of the most effective vaccines available to prevent measles, mumps, and rubella is meeting resistance from many parents because of a debunked study that linked the vaccine to autism. Yet some parents oppose all vaccines. Gabriella Cashman is hoping to start a family soon and says she is not going to give any vaccines to her children.
We don't want anybody to force anything on our children. As parents, it's our decision whether or not we want to vaccinate.
In the U.S., the issue goes beyond autism. It's become a parents' rights issue. Dr. Peter Hotez is an immunologist who develops vaccines for tropical diseases at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston.
We now in the state of Texas have 50,000 kids whose parents are opting them out of getting vaccinated.
Dr. Hope Scott says all pediatricians strongly favor vaccines. The topic is very personal to her because she lost a daughter to pneumococcal meningitis 5 years before a vaccine became available.
Had she been born 5 years later, or had that vaccine been out 5 years earlier, I would have three children, not two. And it is hard for me to have conversations with people who choose not to vaccinate because... I would give anything to be able to trade places with them. You know, I'd give $1 million on my right arm to have had the opportunity to vaccinate my child and save her life. And I didn't have that opportunity.
Doctors and other health professionals are sometimes at a loss when it comes to convincing parents that vaccines will keep their children healthy. In a column written for the Seattle Times newspaper, autism expert Annette Estes said health professionals need to urgently find a way out of our impasse and rediscover the connections between those who oppose immunizations and the medical community. The American Medical Association has adopted a policy to continue efforts to promote public understanding and confidence in the safety of vaccines. Some European countries are now making vaccines against measles and other diseases mandatory. Meanwhile, the measles outbreak in Minnesota is not over. A 19-year-old whose parents opposed vaccinations is Minnesota's 79th case. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
This is the Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. In football, the Confederation of African Football has announced that the 2019 Africa Cup of Nations will be held in June and July. The tournament is usually held in January and February, causing disputes with European clubs who had to release players in the middle of the season. Also, the 2019 event in Cameroon will be contested by 24 teams instead of 16. The changes were announced by the CAF Executive Committee in a meeting in the Moroccan capital, Rabat. Africa's flagship sporting event has featured 16 teams since 1996. The expansion of the tournament could create problems for Cameroon, which will host the next finals, with the Central African Nations Sports Minister having to deny reports that preparations were behind schedule. The competition will continue to be held every 2 years in Africa and only with African countries. CAF was considering whether to allow countries from other continents to compete or even host the tournament. The announcements followed a two-day symposium organized by CAF President Ahmed to discuss the state of African football. Meanwhile, Zanzibar has had its membership of the Confederation of African Football, CAF, rescinded just 4 months after the island was accepted as a member. CAF President Ahmed said Zanzibar, which is part of Tanzania, should never have been admitted as the body's 55th member in March. He said they were admitted without properly looking into the statutes, which are crystal clear according to him. FIFA refused to admit Zanzibar after CAF and Ahmed's predecessor, Issa Hayatou, allowed the East African island into its ranks. Zanzibar is part of Tanzania, but has operated independently as a footballing entity in regional competition. On to athletics, Eliud Kipchoge and Wilson Kipsang will renew their rivalry at the Berlin Marathon on September 24th. Kipchoge, the Olympic champion, will be aiming to break the world record of 2:02.57 set in Berlin by fellow Kenyan Dennis Kimeto in 2014. Kipchoge came within 8 seconds of that mark when winning the London Marathon last year in 2:03.05. He followed that with his triumph at the Olympic Games in Rio, and more recently he clocked an under 5:02.25 in a special experimental run on a race track in Monza, Italy. The women's race will be another battle of former Berlin Marathon winners. Kenya's Gladys Cherono won the 2015 Berlin Marathon in a lifetime best of 2:19.25, making her the fastest in this year's field. But the 2014 World Half Marathon champion will be up against a three-time Berlin Marathon winner, Abedu Kabede. Following victories in 2010 and 2012, the Ethiopian regained her title last year in 2:20.45, just 15 seconds shy of the personal best she set when winning in the German capital 4 years prior. Kabede will be joined in Berlin by compatriots Amane Berisso, runner-up in Dubai in 2016, Glume Tolosa, the 2015 Frankfurt Marathon winner, and Maseret Mengistu, the 2015 Paris Marathon champion. Kenya's Valerie Ayabei Winner in Prague this year with a personal best of 221.57 is another leading contender. Finally, in cycling, Britain's Chris Froome was set to clinch his fourth Tour de France title with a searing time trial performance in Marseille. Team Sky's Froome was expected to ride into Paris for Sunday's final stage with a 54-second advantage over his nearest rival, the Colombian Rigoberto Urán of Conade Adrapa, after putting up an impressive display in yellow on the sunny streets of Marseille. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
Couldn't make a sound. Malaika, nakupenda malaika, ingekuwa maliwe, ingekuwa dada, nashindwa na mali sinawe, ingekuwa malaika, nashindwa na mali sinawe. Ingekuwa malaika,
pesa za somo wa roho yangu, pesa za somo wa roho yangu, ya mwanifanye jivijana
Kidege, akuwaza kidege, kidege, akuwaza kidege, ingekuwa maliwe, ingekuwa dada, nashindwa na mali sinawe. Ingekuwa malaika, nashindwa na mali sinawe. Ingekuwa malaika, malaika, nakupenda malaika, malaika, nakupenda malaika. Ingekuwa maliwe, ingekuwa dada, nashindwa na mali sinawe. Ingekuwa malaika, nashindwa na mali sinawe. Ingekuwa malaika.
What?
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of The Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's One Man's Point of View with Dr. James Jonah, former UN and Secretary General of Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. In the next few weeks, Africa should witness five key elections this year. It has always been said that African elections are a selection process. Nevertheless, it is very important that the people participate in the election of the leaders. When African people participate fully and elect a government, they are much more likely to defend that government as their product. Bear in mind what happened in Sierra Leone in a 1997 coup. The first of the block is Angola. After 37 years in power, President Eduardo dos Santos surprised the international community when he announced that he would not be a candidate this year. It had been rumored that his successor might be a member of the family because it is believed that his family controlled both the economy and politics in Angola. His daughter is considered to be the wealthiest woman in Africa. Isabel is involved in the oil sector and is considered to worth, according to Forbes, over $1 billion. But the MPLA's Central Committee selected instead the current Defense Minister, Lourenco, who, quite frankly, has been judged to be as a clean politician, even though many of the Angolans are supposed to be corrupt. There seems to be no real opposition to the candidate of the MPLA. In fact, since the constitutional change in 2010, there is no longer any direct election of the president. The party with the largest majority have the precedence. So one should expect that the candidate of the MPLA may well emerge as the new president of Angola. The next is Rwanda. Rwanda is also going through an election in August. By a sleight of hand, in 2015, the constitution of Angola was changed to allow the incumbent President Kagame to continue in office and run for the election until 2034. Again, not much opposition in Rwanda, and it's all but likely that Kagame will emerge as the president of Rwanda. The next is Kenya. Kenya is much more worrisome because Kenya has a sad history of violence in elections. Of course, efforts are being made now to ensure that this election will be free of violence. The cast of characters remain the same. The two major contenders will be Odinga and the current president, Kenyatta. And the elections are going on, although the candidates have refused the offer of civil society to hold debates. They are just trying to avoid making any mistakes. What is important also now in Kenya is that they are trying to resolve their disputes through the courts. The opposition opposed the printing of the ballots in the Gulf countries, and the matter was referred to the Supreme Court, which ruled in favor of the Electoral Commission. Similarly, the Supreme Court supported the Electoral Commission in using a supplemental ballot in case of the failure of the electronic one. But things are going well, and it is very difficult to predict really who will emerge as the next president of Kenya. Then we move on to Liberia. In Liberia, that one will take place sometime in October. and the election will be contested by 22 parties. Now, efforts are also being made to have a violence-free election, but free and fair in a level playing field. Just last week, the Supreme Court overruled a ruling of the Electoral Commission that had debarred the candidate of the Liberal Party and others in terms of their vice presidents, saying they had not followed the code of conduct in terms of when they should resign. Now, the head of the Electoral Commission had said that because of the Supreme Court's ruling, there may be problems with the calendar for the election, since they want to apply due process of law to all of those parties contesting the election. So we have to see whether the date of October will remain in Liberia. There's another election which is very difficult to determine, because in DRC, in accordance with the New Year's agreement, there should be elections this year, sometime in December. But we have been seeing dilly-dallying taking place by the supporters of Kabila. And just a few days ago, the Electoral Commission raised doubts that there might be any election this year, which prompted the opposition to consider it a declaration of war. Pressure is being applied, but we cannot say what will happen. But it is very clear that if there is no election this year, there will be violence in the DRC. There is still yet one more possibility of election in the next few weeks this year. In South Africa, there is a vote in the parliament on confidence vote against President Zuma. Should he lose that confidence vote, then there will have to be election this year. Now, these are all what we should be expecting, and we hope that Africans will go to the polls in peace and avoid violence. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, Managing Editor Shaka Sali, Reporter Douglas Mpuga, Producer Odette Frazier, and Engineer for today, Tiang Wang, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, if the owner of the calabash calls it worthless, then the others will join him to pack it with rubbish. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Mexico is a crucial partner for the United States in our efforts to promote a comprehensive energy security strategy and economic security for North America, said U.S. Secretary of Energy Rick Perry. That is why it is a top priority to pursue a North American energy strategy that will ensure security, stability, economic growth for the United States, Mexico, and for Canada. Secretary Perry made these remarks in Mexico City in mid-July when he traveled to meet with President of Mexico Enrique Peña Nieto and Mexico's Secretary of Energy Pedro Joaquin Caldwell. Speaking at a joint press conference hosted by Mexico's Ministry of Energy, Secretary Perry noted, The strategy will guide our collaboration on shared energy interests, including the development of North America's vast, untapped energy resources, diversify our energy supplies, supporting the growth of our domestic energy industries. Energy Secretary Perry said the work plan will identify concrete actions that we can undertake in three areas. First, to accelerate development of our vast, untapped energy resources. Second, to promote energy trade and economic development. And thirdly, to enhance the security, reliability, and resilience of North America's energy systems. The North American Energy Strategy, he said, will build upon our existing ties and bring economic benefits to both the United States and Mexico, as well as Canada. Mexico is already our second largest energy trading partner. Increased energy trade and bilateral investment will increase North America's self-sufficiency that will reduce our reliance on energy imports from outside the continent. Obviously, it will create jobs, a lot of jobs, good jobs, and bring down energy costs for consumers. We are joined together, said Secretary Perry, in the quest for a better tomorrow. Mexico's prosperity is inextricably intertwined with our prosperity. Our cultures are blended. Our heritage and our families are shared. Our economies forever linked. We must build a better future together, starting with a vision of North American energy dominance. We must continue to develop our energy resources, invest in innovation, and build a competitive energy industry together.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.